Welcome to the Bible Talks with Josh and Heather.
The Bible Talks is that show that discusses theology in a simple way.
If you're interested in theology but don't consider yourself a deep theologian, this is the show for you.
Hi there, we're Josh and Heather Tice. We minister to and lead Southern Hills Baptist Church in Las Vegas.
We love each other, love theology, and love to talk.
You can find this and previous episodes on our iTunes podcast or on KVXL 101.1 Experience Liberty Radio.
We always begin with a little fun, so Heather, let's get started.
This is a good one. So here we are to episode 20.
Wow, that's pretty good.
That is good.
I read recently that most podcasts only go to episode 8 and they're done.
Are you kidding?
No, it's true. Well, I mean, wow. That's what I heard on another podcast.
I was about...
So,
clearly. Well, you listen to a lot of podcasts, and they're like on episodes. What's the highest episode you've seen?
I listen to a podcast.
143.
And they are on episode, I'm pretty sure, like 2800.
Are you serious?
Yes, I
am. What
is
serious. That one about? Is it about Disney?
It's the WDW radio show. It's the Walt Disney World podcast.
Okay, see? Yeah. Disney.
Our producer's making notes, like, I'm going to cut this part out later because we're not going to promote some other podcast.
Well, it's Disney. Yeah. They're impossible to squelch.
Yeah.
They will not be squelched.
Right.
Their podcast will be heard.
All my preacher friends right now are saying, why isn't it a leadership podcast you're listening to? What about a preaching podcast? And those preachers clearly don't know me as well as they think they do.
You listen to some of those too, but that is your
but that's not my
your
fun
relaxa-face.
Time. Yes, that's right.
Your
I
relaxation
like
time.
That's right.
So today we're talking about.
Did you say relaxa-phase?
I did.
I think you said relax. That's your relaxa-phase.
Your phase of relaxation.
Oh my word! How long have
your
we been married?
Relaxa-ways.
How long have we been married now?
I don't know.
It's been
you
a long time.
You ask me this all the time in church, and then I have to try to do the math.
It's so funny.
I
say in church, you know, how long, how many years? And our whole church is like, oh, he doesn't know. I'm like, Heather doesn't know either.
No, I don't. I always have to count up.
She has no clue. Why am I in trouble?
We were married in 2001. This is 18, so we'll be 17 this June.
17 years. That's a long time. I don't know if we're going to make it.
I don't either.
Let's be honest.
I know. A few months. Try to hold out. Come on, let's make it to 17. We can do it.
My goal is at least 20. And if we get past that, 50, and then we'll see.
Really?
If we get to 50 and we're
That's
70 years old,
I'm just looking
I don't know,
17.
maybe I want to go to a different direction.
Like, let's just make it to June. Like 1 year at a time, baby. That's what you got to do. All right. Today is episode 20, and we're going to be talking about the crucifixion of Christ.
Yeah. Before we go further, I've got to do a shout out to a few people who have been commenting on our blog. Not only are they rating it 5-star, we have 22 5-star ratings on our blog right
now. Excellent.
That means 22 of our super fans.
Oh my goodness. You guys are awesome. And our tech fans, because they know how to do it.
They did 5-star ratings.
To rate
no,
it
it's a piece
star.
Of cake. You just go on the thing and you press the 5-star. But we have 22 5-star ratings, but we actually have several customer reviews, which is very good because anytime somebody does a customer review, and
what are we
five
selling?
I don't know. It says customer review on the iTunes.
Oh,
thing.
It does.
Yeah. So
that's
it says
the
customer
iTunes.
Review on the iTunes podcast.
Should be
thing.
Listener review. That's
and
weird.
So whatever. Anyway, there's a bunch of them here. And every time somebody gives us a 5-star or writes a review, it helps other people who are looking for Bible content find our podcast.
That's terrific.
And, especially people who like a little humor with their Bible, right? So so here are hold on. The whole time I was looking at the Idea Talks, not the Bible Talks.
Oh, no.
The Bible Talks is our podcast. The Idea Talks is a ministry podcast that I do for ministry leaders.
Well, I feel kind of hurt.
Yeah. Now that sounds like I was trying to do a plug, you know, for the other podcast, and I really wasn't.
I know,
but
and I know this is your favorite because you get to do this one with me.
Right. No, clearly that's true.
I don't know if I can handle this. And now what if there's less customer reviews?
What if there's more?
On ours.
What if
there's
more?
I'm going to be really happy. My day will be magical in spite of my Starbucks drink not being magical. Y'all, I got a Starbucks Frappuccino this morning, and they had the little colored sprinkles on it. I asked for the special and a different drink because I don't want a peach-flavored one.
Hold on, hold on. Before you go forward, let me just say, you can fast forward the next 2 minutes. Go ahead.
No. I'm just stalling.
No, I just wanted
this.
I wanted to help.
And I'm trying to prepare my heart for the disappointment of not having those 5-star ratings.
Heather, stop. Listen to this. We have 19 5-star reviews.
How many did the other one have?
22. We're almost there. And
listen, I need three of
you. That one's been going for like
two years.
Listen,
I just need, no, not three of you. I need four of you. Four. See, I don't do math.
Stars.
This day has not been magical. I should have gotten the math sprinkles. They need math sprinkles at Starbucks, not magic sprinkles. So I need four of you lovely people to go give this 5 stars because, listen, this is about our marriage.
Right.
Josh does this
you
other
determine
podcast
whether or not
with,
we're able
with
to
another
stay
ministry friend who's not me. And they've got more likes. They've got more love. Please go for the sake of our union.
Right. And our children.
And our children.
Now we have here's some customer reviews.
How many customer reviews do we have?
We have, oh my word, we have 6.
Oh,
that's not bad.
This is painful.
No, that's not bad. Okay, look, let's give a few of them. I'm not going to give all of them right now. The first one was by Slacks111. We already talked about that. But there's been several more. T. Whamsy Llama Lover says, Conversations, 5 stars. Conversations about the Bible in a fun and informal way. It gives you something to think about and great topics to bring up with friends. Just a pleasure to listen to.
I love how you read that. You read it like we're a music festival.
T. Whamsy Llama Lover loves the podcast.
Thank you, Llama Lover.
That's right.
And I like that name because I used to be Goat Girl from Bama. That was like one of my names on stuff. Goat Girl from Bama.
All right, listen to this next one.
The Llama Lover.
I love this one because
shout out to you.
I love this one because it's written by a dude. So there are men that listen to this podcast.
How do you know Llama Lover wasn't a dude?
Because
or Slacks.
It could be, but I'm just saying this one says Josh's Rib wrote this one. Wonderful.
Maybe Josh's Rib is his wife because the rib
Hey,
that
dudes,
was so sad. I apologize to all of our listeners for the sexism that has been so blatantly thrown at you this morning or afternoon or evening or whenever you're listening.
Only,
maybe it's midnight.
If it's only ladies listening to this podcast, I definitely need to talk about Pinterest more.
Oh.
What?
Here we go again.
What?
Come on.
What?
Read the review.
Okay.
Just read the review.
So, Josh's Rib, which is clearly, I guess, a woman now.
It could.
This is a wonderful tool for church leaders and young Christians. Thank you for taking time to teach and explain God's word in a fun and exciting way. As a discipler and pastor's wife,
Yay for pastor's wives. What?
As a discipler and pastor's wife, I am always looking for great tools to pass on to young Christians. I have already shared several episodes with young Christians because you hit on a topic that I knew would be helpful to them. How about that? That's great.
Thanks for the review, and thanks for serving in ministry.
Woo. Yeah, absolutely. I'll give one more because Steve089 writes.
Wait, now, I would like to say I think this might be a man.
He writes,
I don't want to be
great
sexist,
stuff, 5 stars. Really enjoyed the latest episode on creation. I have a Creation Science podcast, the Creation Academy, and I am passionate about seeing folks in our movement get more in touch with the reasonableness of our faith. Great job.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. And a fellow podcaster.
Well, clearly, Steve-O knows what it is to brand.
Yeah.
I'm going to go on his, and I am going to write, great podcast. It's just like the Bible talks.
Oh,
no, Steve-O, I think that's
Steve,
good.
Thanks.
That's good stuff, man.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Commenting.
And we've got some other ones. We'll save those for later. One that's HRS522 and Heather Sigh. So there are a couple more here. I'm concerned that Heather Sigh might be you. No. Yeah, all right. So we'll read theirs later, but go on, give us 5 stars and rate. So let's get to our actual podcast.
Goodness.
So today we have a theological discussion that dives deep into the crucifixion of Christ. So it's a pattern for a few episodes that we've been looking at. We talked about the humiliation of Jesus Christ or how he humbled himself in preparation for the cross. Then we'll talk about the crucifixion and in a future episode, the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
I am really looking forward to that one because the crucifixion, that one's I'm bracing myself because it's hard for me sometimes to go to this point.
Right.
Just to be very honest and open. I'm always just so thankful to get to the resurrection. I hate thinking about the humiliation of Christ. I think on the cross,
right?
And what he went through in the preparation to the cross.
Well, it's hard for a true believer to distance themselves and speak of this in terms of purely academia, right?
Right.
Or just speak of this in terms of, well, this is the event, and this is what happened next, and what happened next, because it's so foundational and core to our faith, because it's not merely religion, but a relationship with Jesus. We're talking about somebody that we don't just admire, somebody that we know, and the most difficult moment in his existence, and the most pivotal moment in his existence. So to speak flippantly of it is not easy, right? And even to speak of it in the terms of this conversation may be difficult, but really what we're focusing on today is kind of the timeline. What happened first? Then what happened next? Then what happened going forward? There'll be future podcasts where we discuss the spiritual ramifications of the death of Jesus. But this is really dealing with the timeline. This is really dealing with the events of the Passion Week.
Okay. So let's begin.
Well, let's begin with that concept of the Passion Week. Why do they call it the Passion Week?
I don't know.
I think they started calling it the Passion Week after Mel Gibson released his movie. No, that's not true. He named it after the theological concept.
You know, I have never actually thought about this. I just always assumed it was because it was his love, his passion for us that took him to the cross.
Right.
But I have no idea the origins. Do you seriously know the origins of where this came from?
Okay, so the answer is historical. It goes back to the 2nd century during the first translation of the Bible into Latin. This is before the Latin Vulgate. All of that to say this. It's a historical reference to the Passion of Christ or the suffering of Christ. So it goes to the word suffering. So his suffering begins whenever he enters into Jerusalem. And as he enters in upon that donkey and he looks over Jerusalem and he begins to cry and he says, how often, Jerusalem, would I gathered you like chickens, gathers her chicks under her wing, but you would not. And he begins to weep over that. It's an entire week of deep emotional suffering. So it really refers to the emotional suffering of Christ that leads into the physical suffering of Christ from Sunday to Sunday.
Okay. Yeah. Very interesting.
So
where do we start? Do we start with the court trial?
Yeah, let's start there.
Okay. So one of the little facts, I guess I'm trying to keep it very practical.
Yeah.
And not, as you talked about, the ramifications that later, but what happened? The court trial of Jesus was actually illegal, which some people don't realize that. Many of you probably have heard that preached about, but it's something we should discuss here.
Right. It wasn't that this was a fair trial. I mean, they broke the law in several different ways in actually determining that Jesus Christ was guilty of something. So first of all, it was an illegal trial. What do we mean by that? First of all, the events of the night of the betrayal of Jesus actually included 3 different trials, right? The first one was brought before Ananias and the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin was the group of religious Jewish leadership that was made up of both Pharisees and Sadducees, religious leaders and political leaders, and that's where they condemn him of blasphemy.
Now, this is interesting. That was one of our favorite stops in Jerusalem, and I don't think we even talked about this.
Right.
When we talked about in a previous podcast about Israel, but you can still go to the place where the high priest's house was.
Right.
And you can see, it's neat, you see the courtyard where that's likely where Peter was, which is just fascinating. And then you also can see where they believe that Christ was held.
Yeah, this was one of the most historically accurate places you can go in Jerusalem, it's believed, because they found certain weights and measures that only the high priest would have had access to. And so if that was the high priest's home during the siege of Titus and the Romans in 70 AD, then that probably likely was continued to be the high priest's home some 40 years earlier when Caiaphas was there. And if that was, there was actually an old cistern, an old well. And it was in that cistern or that old well where they would keep prisoners. And if they did keep prisoners there in that specific old well that they excavated, then that would have been the place where Jesus would have spent the night prior to his crucifixion.
And if I can just very quickly, I want to help paint the picture of the timeline here. So Jerusalem, again, is up kind of on a mountain, all right? That's when you go up to the city. This house, if I remember correctly, was kind of on the edge of the mountain, sloping downward. So it was almost I won't say outside the city,
right?
But it was definitely on the edge there.
Right.
And then, of course, where Jesus was taken from before he goes to this point, he was in the garden praying.
Yes.
Remember, that's where they come at night. And that is almost, if you go down through the little valley up to the bottom of the other mountain, that's where the olive vineyard is, the olive trees. That's where Jesus would have been praying. The soldiers, and I hate to even say soldiers because they're really
the
temple guards.
Yeah.
Come, because too often we picture as kids centurions, you know, but it's the temple guards who come at night and take Jesus. And this is where they bring him first. This is
right.
The first stop on the road to the cross. It's kind of right on the edge of the city, right up the halfway up the mountain at the high priest's house.
Right. So this is the place.
That's the first trial.
Yeah. And all the disciples are fleeing away except for John. John follows. And Peter does. Peter follows afar off and he stays in this courtyard. And he kind of sees what's going on, but he can't actually be involved like John because the Apostle John had some kind of high connections with the Sanhedrin. So he was able to go inside. Peter stays on the outside. That's where he denies Christ three times, as you mentioned. So where does he go from there? Well, from there, Annas sent Jesus to Caiaphas, the high priest, and the Sanhedrin at dawn, early in the morning, after he spends the night there. He's then sent to another court with the full Sanhedrin, and then from the Sanhedrin...
Would that have been at the temple?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have gone up to the temple for that.
Okay.
Then later, Sanhedrin then leads Jesus to the council, leads Jesus to Pilate, the Roman governor, in the early morning hours. So that's kind of the timeline. They go from the garden to Caiaphas' home, to the temple for the second trial, and then once they condemn him of blasphemy, they then send him to Pilate. And this is where Pilate says, I don't see anything wrong with him. So that's kind of the outline. Now, why did we say the trial before the Sanhedrin was illegal? Well, first of all, there's several reasons. The Sanhedrin, first of all, met before the morning sacrifice. This was illegal according to the law. According to their own laws, the Sanhedrin were not allowed to meet until after the morning sacrifice. And they were not to meet on Fridays, the day before Sabbath. So both of those made this trial illegal from the beginning. The second reason would be that the witnesses did not agree. There were contradictory statements made in the court, which would have invalidated those witnesses and allowed Jesus to go free.
Now, this is interesting. Now, I'm doing the Bible of the Year, and in my morning devotions, as I listen to it online, and just recently, I'm listening to all these laws. You know, you go through the Old Testament, and you're hearing, you know, about the cities of refuge and all this stuff and trials. And here's what you do if witnesses don't agree. And it's very clear that someone could not be put to death unless there were multiple witnesses that agreed.
Right.
And that is something that, again, didn't happen here.
No. They continued to disagree. But there was, it was predetermined, right? Not only by God the Father that this would be the plan that he dies, but by the council itself, they had already determined, what can we do to kill this man?
Mm-hmm.
They wanted him off the scene. So regardless of how they were going to do it, they were going to break any laws that they needed to.
And let me mention one other thing. This is interesting to me. So if you're curious about the passage, one of the passages it talks about lying and false witnesses in trial and the safety, the rules and laws that would make people consider carefully perjury is in Deuteronomy 19:18-19. And it says, the judges shall make diligent inquisition. They need to carefully question. And behold, if witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So technically, instead of Jesus being crucified, those false witnesses were the ones who should have died according to Old Testament law.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But did they follow that? No, not in any way.
Mm.
As you look at the entire courtroom scenario, they break the law over and over, which is ironic because they're putting to death and condemning a man who had never broken the law in any way. But again, what do we see here? The high priest, what does he do in the midst of it? He tears his clothes, the Bible says in Mark chapter 14 and verse 63. It says he rent his clothes and he said, we don't need any further witnesses. Well, according to Leviticus chapter 22, and he that is a high priest among his brethren shall not uncover his hand nor rend his clothes. But what does he do? Nobody cares what Caiaphas the high priest does. What they care about is putting Jesus Christ to death.
Now, see, that is interesting because I did not realize, I'm sure you know, I've heard that verse and read it, and it's all the other law there in Leviticus, but I didn't realize he wasn't allowed to. But when I think back to, who was it, Aaron, who lost two of his sons, and he doesn't really grieve. There's one thing he does do in the midst of trying to make sacrifices and things. He says, I'm not going to eat this offering that I'm supposed to eat, you know, and take to myself. God's given it to the priest. And Moses questions him. And he says, it would be wrong for me to do that because I'm grieving for my two sons who just were killed. Hophni and Phinehas who were killed.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting. I never thought about it, but he doesn't go through changing his clothes. He doesn't go through rending his clothes. I never realized that's part of the law. And I didn't realize that was wrong. That was part of the things that were done wrong in Christ's trial.
There's another here that is egregious. The Sanhedrin continually changed the charge against Jesus. This was a problem. They kept saying, well, this is what he's guilty of. This is what he's guilty of. In Mark chapter 14, they accuse him of sedition, right? In Mark chapter 14, verse 63 following, they accuse him of blasphemy. And then in Luke chapter 22, we see that they accuse him of treason. Well, the question is, which is it? What exactly is this man on trial for? This is the textbook definition of a witch hunt. They are going after him without any regard to the law. They've got to find him guilty of something, turn him over to the Romans so the Romans can kill him. So where does he go from here? He goes from specifically this second Sanhedrin council, and they bring him before Pilate. Why? Because they themselves would not put him to death. They had a law against themselves putting them to death at this point, and so they were not going to do this. So they send him off to the Romans and get Pilate to accuse him and put him to death. Well, what happens when he stands before Pilate? Pilate has a discussion with him and finds no fault in him. But the Pharisees and the scribes and the entire group begin to stir up the crowd, and they begin to cry out for his death.
And I would just throw in a few things here. I think just over the past few years, I've begun to realize who Pilate really is. When I was a little girl and I would hear this, I almost pictured him like this great king, this high authority. And when you have to realize he was still pretty small bananas, when you consider the vast Roman Empire, he was this person who was sent to this area. And it was an area that the Romans did not like. And I can tell you that was one of the interesting things with being. I've been to Rome. I've seen the splendors of the former empire, even in the rubble. And even when we went to Israel, the nearby city from Jerusalem, the Roman city, is Caesarea. Oh, and it's beautiful. It's coastal. It's got all the amenities. It is where you want to be. Not right. In Jerusalem,
right.
This dusty little town with all these very religious, zealous people and who are always fighting about religion. You know, you just want to be the Roman off there enjoying the coast. And so here's Pilate, who's
Pilate
probably already a little grumpy.
He doesn't want
to get in trouble with
his wife
superiors.
Is mad with him.
Yeah. And so he's got now these religious zealots coming to him saying, kill this man, kill this man. We hate him.
Pilate was a big shot in Israel, but he's small beans in Rome. And so he's concerned for his own position. He's concerned for his own retirement.
And there's this holy day going on, holy week going on in the city, Passover. The city's going to be here. He knows there's going to be filled. He knows there's going to be trouble.
Now these angry group
of
religious...
he'll answer for that.
These angry group of religious zealots bring before him another person. Who is this miracle worker? He claims to be the king of the Jews. Okay, we already have a king. His name is Herod. So he's a rabble-rouser. But then Pilate looks at him, and he thinks, okay, so what's the big deal? So he pulls Jesus aside and says, who are you? And Jesus asks a question, which is beautiful. Jesus says, are you asking for yourself or for somebody else?
Yeah. Asking for a friend. That's where it began.
Yeah.
I'm asking for a friend.
You're asking for yourself or you're asking for a friend? And he looks at him and says, Pilate looks at Jesus and says, why would I ask for myself? I'm not a Jew. I don't care about who you are and your little religious battles and your little magic tricks. I don't care anything about you. Who do you think I am? And Jesus and Pilate have this incredible dialogue where Jesus, in the midst of this passion, this suffering, he sees the soul of a man who needs to be saved. And he begins to reach out to him and love him and try to convince him of truth. In fact, Jesus speaks of truth, and Pilate says, truth? It's truth. And here this poor man could not even see truth when it was staring him in the eye. And finally, Pilate goes out to the crowd and says, I'm sorry, fellas. I see no wrong in the man. If you have a problem with him, he's under the jurisdiction of Herod, the puppet king of Rome. And the puppet king of this area of Judea, and since Herod is in town for this special feast, send him over there because I don't want anything to do with him. My wife is concerned that I don't want his blood on my hands. I don't think there's anything wrong with the guy. Since Herod understands your religion a lot better than I do, send him over to Herod, and Herod will decide what to do with him.
Okay, and a few words on Herod. I think he would be one of my top five grossest people in the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
he's one of these people that I can just picture as just so gross. I know he should be living, you know, a little more well off, but I could just picture him not bathing well. That's at least in my head. I don't know about yours, but Herod is this person who is just a complete mess.
Right. This is Herod Antipas. Okay. So Herod Antipas is the son of Herod the Great, or King Herod, I should say. And he's the descendant of King Herod the Great.
He's not your daddy,
the one
Sarah.
Who built. Herod. Yeah, no, he's the one who built everything.
Yeah.
But this guy was just known to be a partier. He was not the man that his father was, grandfather was, his uncle was, and he meets Jesus, and you really see the character of Herod Antipas when he meets Jesus. Jesus stands before him, and Herod's like, "What are you doing here?" And they say, "Well, this is Jesus of Nazareth." Well, Herod gets all excited and thinks, "Oh, Jesus of Nazareth, I've heard about you." And he asks Jesus to do magic tricks. He says, "Perform a miracle for me. Yeah. I hear that this is what you do. Perform a miracle."
Yeah.
What are you?
He's not questioning the situation. He's not questioning Jesus about who he is. He's just.
Precisely.
Yeah. So self-focused.
And so Jesus says nothing to him because he realizes you don't have any authority.
You know, that is a great application right there. Mm. Jesus gives us a perfect example of, I think, the proverb. There's two proverbs. One is answer a fool according to his folly. The other one is don't answer a fool. Don't waste your words on a fool and his folly. And I think that shows you that there's a time to speak to someone who is foolish in their understanding of God, like Pilate,
yes,
to try to convince him, to try to, you know, bring them to a point of belief. And then there's some people you're going to deal with that they're not interested. They don't want a word. They don't want to consider. And that's where Jesus was. He knew he wasn't being cruel, but there was nothing to say to this man.
Nothing at all. So Herod sends him back to Pilate, and Pilate's like, "Great, what am I going to do?" So he thinks he's going to appease the crowd by having him beaten. So he sends him out to be beaten by a cat of nine tails. Jesus is utterly flogged to the point where the Bible says he's not even recognizable by man. Mm. And then now we see this image in our minds, right? Pilate standing before the crowd with a beaten Jesus, purple robe thrown around his shoulders, crown of thorn upon his head, bleeding profusely. Mm. And he says to the crowd, "Are you satisfied? Are you satisfied? Do you want this man?" Now, Pilate's pulling out all the stops. He's trying anything. He says, "If you want him crucified, how about I release unto you Barabbas? You want Barabbas, this criminal, instead of Jesus?" And the answer to that is, "We want Barabbas, crucify Jesus." At this time, Pilate is just fed up. "These lunatics and zealots I'm done with." Mm-hmm. So he pulls out a bowl of water. He washes his hands and says, "I am free of the blood of this man." Well, you know, good try, Pilate. Good try. That doesn't work. You are the officiating party over the death of the Son of God. I'm pretty sure that's going to come up at Judgment Day.
You know, I want to talk just a minute about the crowd. You mentioned the angry mob. And I think many of us here have never experienced true religious zealot. We have people that are very impassioned for their faith, but I think living in the country we do that's very diverse.
Right.
And was founded upon true freedom, where you have the right to believe what you want and to worship, you know, who you choose.
Yeah.
That's not the case always in other cultures. And I remember at one point when we were traveling, actually a few times as we traveled in different places,
when we were in India, we saw religious zealotry at a level that we had never previously seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the throngs of crowds attempting to appease the gods. We saw this in what some would consider Christendom.
Yes,
within
the
realm of Christianity.
Me.
Terribly.
Yes.
And we were at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem.
Now, this is a place where some argue that this is where Jesus was actually crucified. So it's one of the religious stops in Jerusalem. They also believe he was buried there. They've got a whole shrine, this massive
building
church, and I can't tell you what kind because there's several different
seven different denominations
or groups, cults, whatever you want to call them, have different parts in there that they've claimed it.
Right.
But when we went in there, we were just going in to see it. You know, this was not one of our big stops, I guess, but it's one. It's like, okay, we're here. Do you want to go see it? So you and I went in, and there's a point where they, you know, supposedly the cross was, which I disagree. I think that it was actually located somewhere else. And that's to be debated. But at this point, people will go in and they will kiss the stone. They'll get down and kneel and kiss this place where supposedly is it. They believe the cross was and the blood dripped down. Is that what they were?
Right.
The tradition is. So we go in there and there are hordes and hordes of people. And it's not just people. I've been in crowds, you know, at places like Disneyland where there's anger and grumpy. But I've never been in a place where
downtown where we've been trying to watch a show.
Yes.
And just, you know,
and it's
insane.
Not worth it.
Grumpy,
just leave.
Smelly, and lots of people.
But this was different.
There's
this
a difference
was...
when you see religious zealotry to the point of anger and aggression and striving to please some type of spiritual being. It can be very
frightening.
It
is very dark.
Right.
It is very strong presence. And I will say this. We were in this line, and when I say line, you have to realize it was about, I don't know, 8 to 10 people deep, like wide. It wasn't a single file line. That's not how this works. You're in a mob, and it's, you know, I don't know how many people. Could you even guesstimate? You're better with numbers than I am. How many people were in that small space?
Oh, I'm telling you, in a very small space, there had to have been 600, 700 people.
Okay, and of course, many different languages, many different cultures, which again, is a lot of what I think you would have been dealing with even in Jerusalem in the Passover week. And at one point, Josh and I just decided we needed to go. We just wanted to get back outside. This was not worth it. I'm a little bit claustrophobic. Well, we were kind of pinned in. So we started trying to make our way through that crowd. And I'm telling you, the anger, and it wasn't just about us cutting line. It was, this is a religious thing. It was what you're saying. It was an intense thing. And of course, bless our hearts, we were trying to describe in another language, any language. I'm saying Italian, any word I can for excuse me. We just want to leave. I'm trying to use my very limited, you know, other language skills and motioning. And we got about halfway through and people were angry. They were pushing us. I thought at one point we might get trampled. And thankfully, one of the tour guides began speaking, explaining, you know, new English, and was explaining to the crowd. We just went through and out. We weren't going to cut them. We just were done. And I have never felt a presence before we left like that. And I've never felt, it helped me understand. It gave me a deeper understanding of this crowd. Because we just picture all crucified. No, there is an intense anger and hatred that goes along with the religious zealots that most of us have not experienced.
Right. So what you see here in this moment, you see the crowd saying, crucify, and Pilate's done. So that concept of washing my hands of it, it's amazing that this comes from that moment. And so he says, I'm done. I'm done with this situation. I'm done with all of this. I'm done. And you're right. We put the blame on Pilate, but it's definitely upon the mob. It's definitely upon religious zealotry that has been stirred up by the religious leaders.
And I know there may be some in the mob that just, you know, mobs rise up and people just join in.
Sure.
But I can't help but see it differently now.
Right.
I see it as so much more impassioned.
So what do they do?
And deep set beliefs spurring it on.
The Bible says just very bluntly in the Gospels at this point, and they took Jesus and crucified him. So at that point, he's taken down. He receives the cross. Whether that means it's just the cross beam itself or the entire the entirety of the both beams, and he's carrying the cross. He heads down what's called the Via Dolorosa,
through
the way to Calvary.
Narrow city streets, most of them up and down hills. Imagine working through a crowd anyway. This is Passover week.
Right.
All these people filling these narrow streets of this old city, and you know, guards spreading the way, but you maneuvering in a sense through that crowd with just being a complete spectacle with, you know, a common criminal, the worst of the worst being paraded through the streets to this death.
The prophet Isaiah prophesies this in Isaiah chapter 50. He says that I, the Messiah, would hide not my face from shame and from spitting.
Mm.
And what shame it must have been, right?
Yeah.
Even the writer of Hebrews talks about the shame. It says, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, that is putting up with the shame and going through to get to the point of what? To the point of Calvary. And so when they finally do arrive there, he's laid down upon the cross. The Roman soldiers nail his hands and his feet to this cross. They raise the cross up, and there he stands on the way, in the midst of this busy thoroughfare, to be witnessed by the crowd to die upon the cross. So
now, one of the interesting things, I think this is again something I just learned a couple years ago. If you are studying the account of Jesus being crucified, there are two points where he's offered a drink,
right?
Something to drink. And it can almost, if you're new to the Bible, it almost looks like a contradiction. Like, oh, wait, one gospel says that he takes a drink. The other one says he turns his head away, you know. And it's not actually a contradiction, because if you look at the timeline of the crucifixion, the first one was early on when he's just put upon the cross and is offered not for thirst, but for pain. It would be something, and this is just fascinating to me, and I'm going to be honest, Josh, I don't fully understand why he would not take something for the pain, but he didn't take anything. There was no pain relief whatsoever during this moment. He didn't take it.
Yeah.
Towards the end, where he does take the drink that's offered up to him via a sponge, is right before he says those final words, right before those last statements of shouting out to the Lord, and it is finished. And it's almost just that point of needing something to lubricate his throat just to finish it all right there.
Yeah.
And it just really intensifies the fact that he suffered through it all. And then right at the end, he is just taking something to be able to speak and to shout it out. I don't know. It just gives me a very vivid imagery of those moments on the cross.
So much takes place at the cross. I mean, for us to describe it, it could take several episodes, but really the point of the cross is summed up by one of his closest friends, Peter, in his epistle. When Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 2, he said, "Who his own self bare our sins in his own body on that tree." Why? "That we who were dead to sins should live unto righteousness, by whose stripes we are healed." It was through the stripes and the wounds of Christ, and he's quoting here the prophet Isaiah in chapter 53, and he's saying, by his stripes and his wounds, we have been healed. The blood is the payment for our sins. The atonement has been made because of the death of Christ. And the Bible tells us that's exactly what happens. He takes that punishment upon himself, and so that we could be saved. And there Christ cries out, "It is finished." And when he says it is finished, it means everything that was needed for our salvation was accomplished on the on the cross, at the death of Christ. So my I don't know about you. What's your favorite passage describing the crucifixion? Maybe we can end there. My favorite passage in regards to what happened at the cross takes place in Colossians chapter 2, when Paul is expressing to the Colossians this statement. He says, "Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us." What did the cross do? It blots out the ordinances that were against us, the laws. The law was written to condemn us. We broke the law, we sinned. So what did the cross do? It blots out the handwriting of the ordinance that was against us. And it goes on, "Which was contrary to us, that was fighting against us," that is, the law was fighting against us, "and took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross." "And having spoiled forever principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it." So that's what took place at the cross. The law was taken out of the way. The law was nailed to the cross. The principalities and demons that surrounded were shamed in that moment and made a public show of them openly by dying and triumphing over them. A lot of times we think the resurrection was the moment that the demons were defeated. And according to Paul in Colossians chapter 2, it was the moment he died that they were publicly shamed, which is a beautiful thought.
That is a really good passage. In fact, it's very theological. That was not the direction my mind went to when you talk about my favorite passage. When I think about the whole entirety of the crucifixion, the moment that strikes me most, and that honestly just I hope I can get through saying it, is in Luke, where he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And when I consider all these things that are going on, all that Jesus has been through, the lack of sleep as he's been up, you know, all this time praying, and then, carried from place to place, as we talked about, and he's been tortured and shamed and mocked, and all these people, even can you imagine the going through the street even with the cross and people,
yeah,
you know, mocking and spitting, and you know, yeah, it would just be something to join in at that point, you know, putting down this accused criminal. And when he gets there and the Roman soldiers are doing so much more to him, right, and he's being crucified, where he just makes that statement.
Yeah.
Thinking about them. And I think it's so easy for me, even on a good day, to be self-centered. Yeah. And to be all about me. But to think about the Lord, even in these moments of pain and agony, that his thoughts were not about himself. That in that moment, he could think about them and realize the guilt that many of them who would convert would carry and have to overcome, to realize what they were thinking and doing. It just is amazing to me, and just such a challenge to my heart. And I love that that's the heart of our Savior, that he was thinking of us.
We want to thank you for listening to episode 19 of the Bible Talks with Josh and Heather. On the next episode, we're actually going to be talking about marriage questions and answers. People have been emailing me some questions and answers, and you.
Excited about that.
And we'll be discussing that on the very next episode. If you'd like to connect with us further, you can go to our Facebook page, The Bible Talks with Josh and Heather. Here we can interact, take requests for upcoming episodes, and answer your questions. Email us at pastor@southernhillslv.com.
And heather@southernhillslv.com.
We would love to hear from you. And there's one thing we want to ask you to do before you go.
And that is, will you please subscribe to this podcast?
That's right.
If you enjoyed it, hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss a single episode.
Again, thanks for listening, and remember,
when the Bible talks,
we'd better listen.